Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp.
Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Lorraine Van Tulle, and we're going to be talking about her new book, Amazon Wisdom Keeper, A Psychologist's Memoir of Awakening. With captivating lyricism, Amazon Wisdom Keeper transports us into the multicultural upbringing and transformation of Lorraine Van Tulle, a graduate psychology student and budding shamanic healer who's blindsided by startling visions, elusive drumming, and her inseparable mystical ties to the Amazon rainforest of her native Suriname. You can find out more about Lorraine and her book by visiting her website, www.thesacredhealingwell.com. And I do have a direct link to Lorraine's website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Lorraine to the show. Good day, Lorraine.
Hello, Robert. Thank you so much for having me. I am so looking forward to this. And thank you so much for holding this beautiful space for inspiring conversation.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I just love the people who have studied psychology and then are changing the look of what that's like. When I went to college and took psychology in the early 90s, we wouldn't have begun to examine some of the things that you have, and it's exciting to see that the changes that are happening. So, I'd like to start first of all by, if you wouldn't mind sharing, what is it in your background that motivated you to write Amazon Wisdom Keeper?
Yeah, sure. That's a wonderful question. And I just wanted to mention, to me, it was so important to also frame my experiences in a time period. I'm not sure if the few times I mentioned that came through, but I did go to school in the 90s. So it was quite challenging. Actually, I went to a traditional program, so I didn't know what was coming through, and I did not have a lot of footholds. I'm from Suriname, which is a little country above Brazil, and even though mystical traditions are very colorfully interspersed throughout the society, it's not my direct lineage. I grew up in the city and was exposed. It's a very small capital that I was also born and raised in, maybe about 250,000 people. And most of the country is covered by Amazon rainforest and trees. It's, according to the World Bank, the most tree-covered nation in the world. So you can imagine there are cultures, the indigenous cultures, there were Maroon people who were descendants of runaway slaves who had lived in the rainforest for many years, actually centuries even, and had just recently come to the cities. Then there were people from India and Indonesia, China. It was just a real mecca of many different cultural influences. And so I was exposed to all that. And there was a lot of spirituality and traditions that were in performances in schools and in the streets during holidays that really influenced me. And I was drawn to them like a magnet. Drumming and different sounds and things really lived in my body. And I really believe that even at a young age, I was really drawn to this idea. I, of course, had no cognitive understanding of this, but just the idea that we're spiritual beings having a human experience more than human beings having a spiritual experience. So you had a mixture of those influences, but I kept on veering towards the first, and that became the driving force, that became my true north, that guided me throughout my later awakening.
What would you say was the inspiration behind this book? I mean, obviously, it's a memoir, so,
yeah.
So putting your life out there for everybody to to examine.
So in my situation, I think I was from a young age most drawn to human relationships. And I didn't have a keen understanding of this, but I had a real good sense of when things were off. And it was, to me, as clear as, the trees being green and the sky being blue. So when my parents or adults or people around me were in conflict, that would stick on me and really bother me. And I didn't understand that. I was being really porous and a bit psychic, and this energy was bothering me, and I wanted to balance it. And I just kind of intuitively knew, if I now had to use the elements, that, people sometimes need to calm down, meaning they had to ground more or lighten up or needed to face the heat, face the truth a little bit more, stand in that more, or just not run off and kind of evaporate. I had this intuitive sense using my body and my sort of natural wisdom to do this, and I felt that adults just wouldn't believe children that they could possess this wisdom. So I veered towards some of my childhood heroines and imaginary friends, which were Anne Frank and Helen Keller and Joan of Arc, the books that I would read. And they gave me permission to trust myself and also to have intuitive awareness. I didn't think of it as an intuition. I thought of it as Helen Keller would say, listen to your heart, and your heart is able to see things that your eyes can't see, that sort of thing. And so I began to trust that this was possible. I didn't have to have words for it, and I also believed that a young girl could lead adults in some ways, even though they might not believe them what's going on. So Anne Frank also made it okay for me to be in hiding about it, to sort of keep it a secret. And I couldn't, I didn't have a diary or notebook, but I had fantasies of that. So I would kind of mentally in my mind make all these notes of things. And that's how the idea started of writing a book. I thought, I need to write a book. I need to tell the adults what's happening, but I need to wait till I'm I'm older.
Mm. Wow. Would you mind sharing with the listeners? Well, first of all, it's interesting. You talked about Helen Keller. I'm a little bit of a amateur nature photographer, and I took a picture in the park this past weekend of a blue heron, and it was just to me it was just a beautiful thing, and I think usually I like to try to find quotes that can kind of go along with what I feel that the picture was telling. And it's just really interesting, as you were mentioning Helen Keller, I thought, oh my God, I did that on Sunday. The one quote from Helen Keller that I used was, the best and most beautiful things in the world cannot be seen or even touched. They must be felt by the heart, which is exactly what you said.
Exactly.
It's like, oh my God. Dang, I just used
that's
that
exactly
quote.
The one I was referring to, yeah.
Yeah, so, would you mind sharing with the listeners a little bit about what it was like? Now, you left Suriname when you were like 13 or 14, correct?
That's correct.
Is that correct? Yeah. So now, would you mind explaining, I just thought it was fascinating when I was reading about your youthful experience there. Would you mind sharing a little bit? Because I would think that that's just so unique and foreign to many of us.
Sure. So when I was 10, there was a revolution in my country, and after a few years, things just got increasingly worse. There were kidnappings and curfews and quote-unquote accidental deaths and shootings, and it became more and more real because at first I really had a hard time believing that this was really happening because we had been a peaceful nation for so long. But some people took over after Suriname became independent. And so my real Achilles heel in terms of speaking my truth, I had already decided, okay, I can speak my truth, hold my truth, at least to myself. But when that happened, it became a huge big deal for me to keep quiet because so many people for political reasons could get picked up, and I was terrified of saying the wrong thing. And so that's when my mind really became foggy and I lost my connection to my truth and started to live in fear, while before I really experienced that my true nature was love. And so fear became more of a dominating thing. And when I left my lifeline, also my nature sanctuary, which we, you know, visited every weekend with my family, and moved to Miami in this concrete jungle, I was really susceptible and vulnerable to the influences of this new culture, not speaking the language, trying to fit in, living in a community that was quite quote-unquote hip and with it and feeling so backwards. And so there was a lot of pressure, a lot of pressure on myself to try to be cool and fit in and re-experience this aliveness. And of course, during that time of adolescence with hormones and everything going awry, that was the way to go and the way I was going to be alive. So I joined this drill team. I hung out with the wrong crowd, and my parents had a lot of trouble adjusting themselves financially and professionally. So my father moved to California, and here I was just with my brother and my mother, and basically did as I pleased. I thought, as long as I did okay in school, I'm fine. And so started to hang out with the wrong crowd and had to learn the hard way when things, you know, I couldn't continue, and ended up with a possessive and very jealous boyfriend that this was going the wrong direction. And that's when I became really determined to redeem myself and started to go on a healing path.
Yeah. So, you know, the one thing I thought it was when I was reading about, the start of the coup takeover, when you were talking about how you were basically running, climbing a tree to see exactly, you know, what was happening. You know, I mean, it was just like, I had this image of, it was just something, you know, it was just unfathomable, you know, something like that. And you know, you do a wonderful job in your book, you know, describing that. And so now with the move to Miami, so one of the things I was wondering is, when did you decide to study psychology? How did that course of study come into your realm? Why is it that you did that? What were some of the motivations for that?
Yeah, so even though in hindsight now, looking at my younger years, I would read ferociously. I would read this little advice column. It was similar to a Dear Abby when I was a child. And it seems like in hindsight, I was just, you know, called to do this. But my family, psychology, psychotherapy, that sort of thing, was not an integral part of my culture at all. There was shamanism and that kind of and healings and ritual, but not psychotherapy or much talk about emotion. So it's kind of interesting that it took a bit of veering off the beaten path to get to psychology. The reason I did, I was actually doing very well in math, and part of my redemption was to become a good student. My mother was a junior high school principal, and even though I had sort of rebelled against her logical ways and schooling and all that, after I had messed up so badly, this was in my mind now imprinted as the story. This is how I'm going to redeem myself. So I became a good student and was really encouraged to pursue math and the sciences and the more of the heart, you know, the real professions and careers. But it was in my English class when I started to read and really get into some of the psychology of characters that I thought this was way more interesting. And it was my calculus teacher who explicitly, I don't think she was aware that I wanted to study this, but she was explicit about psychology being a Mickey Mouse major, and actually not the first who had those kinds of attitudes, which actually sparked my interest even more, thinking, wow, what is this all about? Why is this considered a Mickey Mouse major? And perhaps it was because I also didn't trust her, for her to talk down and always kind of drawn to the shadow, you know, being kind of a devil's advocate, being curious. And so when I explored that, it became more and more clear this is what really intrigued me.
Yeah. Well, so now you mentioned the, you know, with, you know, being in Suriname, you know, with the military and how you kind of clamped down on your voice, you know, what, and you're just watching what it was. So, you know, that along with, you know, censorship, you know, it's a reoccurring theme throughout your book. So how did the expression of your voice, how did that contribute to your spiritual awakening?
Yeah, so my voice in my adolescence, when I first got there, there was even a period where I would say, selectively mute, because I would speak so little, and I was so self-conscious about speaking in English and being teased. So I did a lot of writing. And as a child, I had the fantasies of writing my truth, but we never were taught to write essays. I mean, our education was mostly copying from the board in our notebooks, lessons, history, biology, you name it. And so we had to protect paper. We could not waste any of our paper for frivolous things. So I didn't have a lot of experience writing till I started to write my friends. And that was such a relief for me to really bare my heart, and that's where that started. So it was mostly on paper that my voice slowly came back. And then later on, the same thing happened. I met the love of my life. We had a long-distance relationship, more of that. And through that writing, I really gained so much deeper insight into who I was, what I wanted, and some of these early memories came back. It was with him also when I bought my first diary with a lock on it, and rather than, you know, writing it full of you know, the romantic aspects of what was going on of my life, it was really my relationship with my young self that emerged on the very first pages. Like, I dreamt so long of having you, of having this diary. I had a name for it, Penelope. And I just poured my heart into this diary. And so just slowly but surely, now as I continued on my studies, I at first thought I was going to become an academic and a researcher, also because my undergraduate program did not have a clinical department. And it was until the 11th hour in my senior year when I thought, oh, maybe I should try this abnormal psychology course, and again, fell in love. So this has been sort of the story of my life. And so I decided to do that and worked for the Air Force Base, the Family Support Center. but didn't know that I was really being geared towards a public administrative position as a director. So I did work with families, but it wasn't going to continue. So I decided, no, this is not what I want. And then I enrolled in a clinical psychology program, which was more a balance between a practitioner and a science research program, which was already like a big risk leap of faith for me. But I thought I had landed. I thought I was finally home. I was being brave and pursuing my heart. And so when I started to discover there in the second year or so in my ethics classes that evidence-based treatment was really important, that if we just followed our intuition, that we were deluded into thinking that we weren't self-serving and that sort of thing, that really started to trigger me on a very, very deep level. And that's when I started to hear the sounds of the drumming and my old self coming through, and I didn't understand what was happening. But that's when I started to write ferociously, mostly funneling it into research papers, studying multicultural psychology, studying spiritual psychology, wanting and also having a lot of wisdom teachers around me with their sayings, mm-hmm. and just not understanding why I could not integrate these two and bridge these two. But that's how my voice started to come back again on paper, and eventually in my interactions with supervisors and other colleagues, started to voice this more and more. But it did a dissertation also to help me articulate more what I was really objecting against.
Yeah, isn't it interesting that when you were talking about the notebooks and copying down, you know, biology, math, and all those kinds of things, and that you didn't have, you had to be aware of having enough paper and not writing about frivolous things, you know, where, and then when you're talking about your diary and those, I guess, would be considered, quote, the frivolous things, you know, from back then, and it's like, okay, now, really, what has had the biggest impact on your life? Was it the writings in the diary to your younger self, or was it the copying down of, you know, stuff on the board? And it's interesting because I think, you know, that that perspective is what I think guides a lot of modern, you know, thinking in the sense of, you know, what's most important is, you know, those subjects and the facts versus the heart, you know, and the emotions and the relationship with self, you know, and it's just, I guess it would be like in hindsight that, you know, really what is frivolous?
Exactly. I have that interwoven throughout the book that there was such an agenda, I suppose, and this was coming from my mother as well. I don't think it's an accident I got paired with her, being unusual in this culture, because she was one of six girls, and there's 13 of them total. She was the only one who studied abroad in Holland for 8 years. She was the most ambitious one, most high-strung, and came back and was feared by her female teachers and male teachers both, because she was so regimented and strict and believed in education, because it had pulled her out of a very hard childhood and made a better life in her mind for all of us. So I had this right at home as the obstacle to deal with. But it was all throughout the culture, also this bias against this factual education and schooling rather than a deeper education of the heart and then a more holistic sense of self. But this also continued on throughout my undergrad and my graduate school, and frames sort of the conflict that I'm having in between the rational mind, between this knowing and and understanding in terms of logic, and then this awareness of our soul that exists beyond our age and beyond reason and cognition.
Yeah. So, you know, as I said in the beginning of the show, yeah, I find it, you know, fascinating the changes that are occurring in people who major in psychology, who follow the path of psychology, but also have this strong intuitive, natural side that is calling them to marry the two. So with your work, do you find that you kind of, do you rely on some of the traditional classic psychology approaches to helping clients, or do you find that you incorporate a lot more of the intuitive, the shamanic, you know, that aspect?
Mm-hmm.
Or does it depend on the client?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I would say that the short answer to that is yes, I do both. I see the traditional, meaning the conventional psychology training that I have as a subset to the holistic. And for the longest time, why it was problematic, and I must say I want to frame my education, my program, as I said, was I started my program in 1994 and graduated in 1999, and a lot of changes have been made now to it. There's mindfulness and meditation, all kinds of other programs and courses that I've taught, but not so much when I was a student. I think existential psychology was the only one. There are also many other programs that had existed then and exist now, such as the Sophia Institute and other CIIS in this area, especially in California, that teach this transpersonal approach, even in the traditional programs. But in my situation, I really had to acquire this additional accreditation and training to do that. So I am now a depth hypnosis practitioner, and that model is based on transpersonal psychology and hypnotherapy, Buddhist psychology, shamanism. And what I feel is important is to get people on board, and often they come with their ego mind stories in terms of what they need help with, what's been troubling them. The nice thing about my referral service, which is UC Berkeley, and also my website, is very clear how I work. I really ask them to refer people who have the same mindset. So it's from the get-go, very clear how I work. I double-check with them in my informed consent to make sure that they understand how this is different from traditional psychotherapy. And mostly what I say and how it's different is that pain is really welcomed as a portal, and symptoms have so much information. We're going to go in them as a deeper layer. We almost follow them as the breadcrumbs, while a traditional psychotherapist might, or the client, him or herself, might want more relief and see the symptoms as problematic. Of course, if they're overwhelmed by them, I'm totally fine with whatever relief is needed to get them to a place where they can do the work. But for the most part, when they're able to tolerate them that, and I do teach meditations and things like that where they learn to ground and they learn techniques to make it much more tolerable for them. And then with the help of guides, which is a little different than how other shamans or shamanic practitioners might work, I really focus on helping them connect with their own guides. So with the help of their guides, they try to dig deeper into the meaning of the symptoms or the traumas and get greater insight into what it is, where they're stumbling, and what gifts these experiences might have. So, yes, it's very much with all the clients that I work with that I use mm-hmm. this holistic approach.
Okay, great. Well, we are just halfway through the show, Lorraine. I want to take just a quick break, and I do want to invite listeners that if they would like to call in and ask any questions, they can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions you would like for me to pose to Lorraine, feel free to type them in. And then when we come back, Lorraine, you know, we've been talking a little bit about, you know, shamanic practices, and I would be curious to find out what your experience, your personal experience is with your shamanic journey. How did it start? What was that like? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Wonderful.
Okay. Great. Okay, everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this very brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link to the approximately 1,000 shows that we have had over the past 5 years. Our show is available as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. You can subscribe there, or even quicker, there is a link to our show on iTunes on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, etc., and we have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. And finally, also on the site is a link to the great products we provide: books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store with essential oils and personal and spa products. There is so much for you to explore and enjoy on our website, www.biteradio.me. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone. Thank you for staying with us. Again, today my very special guest is Lorraine Van Tool, and we're talking about her new book, Amazon Wisdom Keeper, A Psychologist's Memoir of Awakening. Again, you can find out more about Lorraine, her book, and her work by visiting the website www.thesacredhealingwell.com. And again, I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. Okay, so with that, we're back, Lorraine.
Yes.
Okay, great. So tell us about, you know, I've always been interested in shamanism and just that whole perspective. To me, it's just so mystical. So what was your first experience? How did you venture in that realm?
Well, there are a few that I recall and I mentioned in the book as well. One was that we had a housekeeper who wore many different hats, which is typical in the Caribbean, and her background was Maroon. She was also a descendant of slaves, and I should mention as well, so was my great-grandmother. And there's something about our connection. It was almost like we were cut from the same cloth. And whenever we went to a little bit deeper in the interior, in the rainforest, we had a patch of land that my parents cultivated and visited every weekend. And also went to swim in the rivers, cool off in the creeks, that sort of thing, which is typical. But she would always sit me down, and I liked to spend time with her in the back room. And she would tell me about the nature spirits and Watramama especially, which translated is the water goddess, and told me that I needed to respect the nature spirits and I needed to communicate with them and stay safe that way. Basically, if you didn't respect them, you could be harmed. And so she really got my interest, and it made intuitive sense to me. It wasn't uncommon for small children to drown, and this was the way in a parable form that they, Maroon people especially, would teach the children to be much more cautious and respect the forces of nature. And so with that in mind, whenever I roamed in nature, and I really don't think this is unique to me, it's unique to many of us if you read books about the nature fix and nature principle, or many mystics and writers and artists get their inspiration when walking in nature, being in nature. There's just a part of our mind that opens up and becomes more expansive, which is, I believe, what shamanism is and many of other healing traditions where people tap into our fullest human potential and tapping into psychic realms and other more subtle realms. So that would happen to me. And it's also not that unusual in my culture, where the logical mind is not so harshly defined, I would say. There's a lot of bleed-throughs, a lot of sort of switching from realm to realm in ways people speak, and no identification. I'll just give you a concrete example of something that just happened very recently. You could visit Suriname and find in a newspaper story of a boy who's reincarnated, and it's just like, it's not fake news, it's just news. and it would be all the facts and all the reasons why this family believed this and that. So there's a lot of things that would happen that I would not identify as this is psychic or this is shamanic-like, and was shared with many other people around me. And so I had conversations with sort of the nature spirits in terms of things that would upset me, and I would get insights. Some of them I write about also in the book. And then this would carry out in my dreams. And I believe that's where I first became aware of some, I call it kind of a ninja fighter, this feisty part of myself that began to guide me. And then I see my childhood friends kind of as my early spirit guides, Anne Frank and Joan of Arc and Helen Keller, as well as some of the rebel slaves and people that I learned about in my history class. And it wasn't unusual for me to have communications, kind of just what happened to you, synchronistic experiences with writers or great minds who had passed and come back in my life and felt like they were guiding me. So all that seemed very normal till I moved to the United States and I started to really identify this is weird. I think in Suriname there was a little bit of that and a little bit of, okay, some things I really need to keep a secret. But there's a lot that was gray, in the gray area, and in the United States it became much more clear. Keep this hidden and this is off limits, till I could no longer. And it started to really emerge, and it's almost like my spirit guides, you know, sort of came back with a vengeance and wouldn't be locked up. So, so that's how that happened, and I was really sort of the stakes were getting higher, and me staying quiet about things was not going to happen any longer, and so things started to come out more in the open.
Yeah, I can understand that. You know, the one thing that I find fascinating is just the where the United States sometimes there's the national consciousness of being progressive or being, you know, modern, and what I have found is, I mean, through the years I've had quite a number of guests who have had either childhoods like yourself in countries, or they're still living in countries where the relationship with nature is just so much stronger, you know, and it just seems that, you know, here in the U.S. we have, you know, the technology and urbanization has really taken a toll in separating us from nature, and it's like you said, you know, sometimes, you know, the things that you had to kind of clamp down on, you know, to me it's it's sad that that is that's something that's viewed among many around here, you know, as being unusual, odd. Even, you know, I what's your feeling about, you know, mental illness? And sometimes we view someone who view them as maybe mentally ill, have some kind of mental illness, when in fact they may be experiencing some of the kind of the mystical or so just some of the experiences that are kind of extraordinary, metaphysical in nature. You know, I mean, to me it seems that, you know, that some, I mean, in some cases, if you were to tell someone that you saw a ghost or you saw somebody, you know, I mean, a long time ago, it would have been, you know, you definitely would have gotten locked up, gotten like therapy and all kinds of strange stuff. Now it's a little bit better, but there still is a kind of a stigma that is attached to someone who experiences something out of the ordinary.
Yes, yes. I'm following all that. I was just thinking how very sad it is. It's a huge loss. I think of it as so ironic. To the most difficult challenge in our lives is really the simplest, to be our true selves, to really honor our true nature. And there are so many cultural layers that are preventing this and have prevented this over the generations. And so I was, you know, in terms of answering your question, this has very much been my mission, my focus with my clients, that I do believe that there's a certain order in which this culture and many others, you know, have established sort of the norms, the status quo, and they directly clash with spiritual order, with the higher truth and our true nature. And so when we get nudges from the inside or from our spirit guides, which I think of as really some sort of embodiment of what's in our shadow, some sort of form taking to get our attention. And so when it could be a visual, it could be a feeling, could be sound, and sometimes it is also ghosts and ancestors that match that particular thing that a client or a person might be avoiding, and they're bringing this gift. Sometimes it's a spirit out of a body who is struggling with the same thing, and it's almost like they see the potential in you to heal, and they latch on, hoping to get a free ride. And that causes many of us to feel like we're carrying all this weight and keep on working on the same issues. These are all things that I've seen in my practice. But to answer your question, yes, I do believe it's almost a given that for us to align ourselves more with our true nature, spiritual order, it will require that we experience mental disorder. And it's just a reframe of the whole thing. This mental disorder might be a good thing, be the best thing that's happening to us. Now, I also don't want to minimize or dismiss people who do struggle with mental illness, that there are so many influence and factors and difficulty. I'm not by any means trying to say that, oh, just flip your perspective and all should be well. But I do find it sad that many don't have the right container or work with somebody who has the tools to really help them excavate layer by layer what is contributing to their awakening, to really reclaim and own their light. Marianne Williamson said that our deepest fear is not that we're inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It's our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. And while that is true, what I would say is it's not just our light that frightens us. We really live in a society where that light and that power is triggering to a lot of people, and still to this day can lead to attack, violent attack, or all kinds of ways to eliminate us, whether that's professionally or whatnot. So it's not just our light frightening us, it's the repercussions of standing in our light and our power that frightens us. So when people are awakening and really becoming more powerful and having all this depression or mental illness and imbalances, anxieties, fears of really standing in that light, depression perhaps, grieving the loss of not having and not being able to stand in the light, or mental bipolar, different mental illnesses are all related to how we've been running that energy because of the resistance that we've often faced in our family, but also in society, and then also historically, because as we expand further out, become more psychic, we're tapping into so much unresolved historical trauma, healing, lack of healing that is now surfacing, and we have no idea how to do that and what that all means, so it can become very overwhelming. So I do believe that people can be healed. I have helped many powerful healers go through this whole journey from severe mental illness and completely come out at the other end. But it's not for the faint of heart. It's a hard journey, but it's very possible and empowering.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I recognize and appreciate you, your comment about the recognition of, you know, some mental illness, you know, does require, you know, intervention. I mean, does have a basis that sometimes, you know, a shamanic approach or a switch in perspective, like I said, isn't enough, you know. And the one thing that it seems that, you know, and it's funny because when you talked about how, you know, how people kind of can switch it up. I have a gentleman scheduled for a show next month. He's a youth, young adult child, you know, the teen kind of writer, adventure writer. He's a pilot, but he also has synesthesia, you know, the experiencing things in different senses, like maybe smelling a freshly baked item will be blue, you know, instead of the smell. Mm-hmm. In times past, you know, that would, I would think, for some people have drove some people mad, you know, that having that experience, not being able to relate it to someone who does, I mean, in such a rare condition, you know, that it would be just viewed as the guy was crazy, you know what I mean? Back in those days, you know, it would have been the case. But it's now understanding the condition. I just found it fascinating. I mean, I usually don't, you know, book, you know, novels, you know, young adult novels. But just the idea that he is a pilot and has this condition and is going out to teach, you know, elementary school kids all about the whole thing and then having them tell their story. To me, it was just it's a way, I guess, that he embraced that uniqueness and is using it to educate. And then I think that, you know, what you're doing as far as having psychology be a subset of the holistic approach, I think that holistic approach is really what is going to, I think, shed more light or kind of open up, you know, people's eyes or raise awareness. And I think, isn't that, once that happens, then healing and expressing yourself, your authentic self. I mean, that all then becomes easier once you take that holistic approach.
Yeah, very much so. As you were describing this condition, I would even argue that perhaps it exists on a continuum. And another way to look at this holistic approach, or how I sometimes call shamanic healing, is that it's creative ingenuity. And in that creative process, there's often this kind of mismatching or crisscrossing of senses and experiences that happens. It's the same, I think, for artists and writers, where you're trying to uniquely and creatively compare maybe one thing or an experience with another in an unusual pairing of sorts. Now, this happens a lot in a shamanic journey. In all my healing sessions, I go in trance with my clients, and as they connect to their guides or ask for insight into a particular issue, it could be presented in such a way. There are physical symptoms. There's even a line of questioning that I learned from my depth hypnosis teacher, Isaac Bucciardi, from the Sacred Healing Well, where we do a bit of a body talk and concentrate deeply on the symptoms and ask what colors or forms or temperature, shape, phrase, that sort of thing, are coming to mind. And and it's not just an animal, power animal, as we think of shamanic journeying in this, the way I've been taught it. It could be this fiery red ball, you know, in the stomach that is now willing to speak and has been there since whatever incidents and plays this particular role. So I think it's when I say that we need to demote the rational mind a bit and make it a subset of the holistic mind, this is kind of what I'm referring to. I think we've been taught a little bit too much to think in straight arrows when it comes to a rational mind. That is not really natural. I think of it as more of how nature is, in this very playful and colorful and organic way. And if we allow our minds that freedom, I think you see more of that, and this wonderful creative energy is unleashed.
Yeah, exactly. So now there was there's one thing that you say about that it only takes one black swan to prove that all swans are not white, prove that not all swans are white. So how does that apply to Amazon Wisdom Keepers?
Well, evidence-based research, especially in clinical psychology, I know research in many other professions are just in the lay population can mean many different things. It can be gathering knowledge and interviewing people. In clinical psychology and hardcore sciences, that would all be considered kind of pseudoscience and very self-serving. The legitimate studies really require good-sized groups that are selected by random samples. You have a control group. You operationalize what you're studying, and you have to factor that out precisely, and it has to be a study that could be repeatable. And so you're looking for this active ingredient, and even it's often very biased because you're trying to see if this particular medication or particular treatment is working. So if any other thing factors in, it's called a placebo, and there's so much that got lost in this idea of this is just a placebo while it's the mind doing these amazing, wonderful things. But in any event, so often we in our research classes, we were reminded that you really can't prove anything. That's another thing to be careful of. You're really just looking and making sure that two things are correlating with each other beyond statistical, that it's not by chance. you're trying to say that the likelihood of something is so small that this did not happen by chance, and this is as close as you can get. Now, the example that they often use with swans is basically saying you can never prove that all swans are white. You're only saying the likelihood of finding a white swan in a particular area is great. But if you just have one black swan, it can debunk that whole theory. So there are a lot of theories in Western psychology that have been tested on mostly Western populations, often students, that even though they're really robust and really solid, are more of the white swan theory. The black swan just hasn't come along to disprove it. So in this case, I believe that my book is like the black swan, because there is this belief also that just using this evidence-based research is getting rid of all the self-serving biases, and we can with blind faith trust that these are the best and most effective theories. And what I'm showing in my book is it's not necessarily the case. When I look at all the different research, the theories and the different experiences that I know with myself and others, that sometimes the ego mind, even for researchers, can still be so biased, can still influence the lenses in what they study, and that our whole field, could really benefit from a soul retrieval and looking deeply into our truth and relying on our intuition a little bit more, that looking at my story and how that all panned out, that in my situation there might be some things where I was less biased, even though I did not use research, or the people who I study from Suriname who none of them are academics or studied any of the things that we're talking about, and they might be more clear and more in point, not using any research. So using this particular example, I think it could be a black swan that opens a lot of conversation.
I agree. Well, this has really been a wonderful talk, Lorraine. I really appreciate your spending your time with me. Now, on your website, you have a list of your different services, and you do Amazon Goddess Retreats too, correct?
Yes, that's correct. I'm most excited about that. I will be having them in Costa Rica in April of next year. I'm also going to have several more talks in the Bay Area. There's a calendar on my website, The Sacred Healing Well, and I have a separate website also, Retreats for Amazon Wisdom Keepers, and that pertain to these retreats, and they're renaturing retreats, helping participants, mostly women for now, deeply reconnect to their true nature using the elements, getting to know their unique dream team of guides to help them really reconnect to their true nature and their power.
Yeah, great. And I do, by the way, you do have a wonderful blog, the Learn to Be a Well blog, some great articles there, some great posts, that you have there. So definitely want people to go check that out. They're just very thoughtful. So it's a great addition to on your website. So again, Lorraine, I really want to thank you for your time. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much, Robert. I really enjoyed it myself, too, and hope to be in touch for another one sometime in the future.
I hope so. That would be great. I would like that very much. So, Now, are you on social media at all?
Yes. I do have I have a Sacred Healing Well Facebook page. I have an Amazon Wisdom Keeper Facebook page, but I also have a closed group, and it's called Awaken Your Amazon Wisdom Goddess, and anybody could request to join that group. And what I do in that group is introduce some of these ideas, the meditations, more articles that particularly support women in awakening this part of themselves, this light and power, and using some of the tools that I teach to help dissipate the fears and heal the old traumas that might be triggered.
Great. Well, that's great. And I'll be sure to let some of my friends, female friends who love that empowerment, to let them know about your group. So, again, thank you for your time, and I look forward to keeping in touch.
Okay, great. Wishing you all the best, and also to
thank you. Thank you. Hey, again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Lorraine Van Tool. We've been talking about her new book, Amazon Wisdom Keeper, A Psychologist's Memoir of Awakening. And again, you can find out more by visiting her website, which is www.thesacredhealingwell.com. And again, there is a direct link to her website in the show page description. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.